please.
Thanks. Okay, I think hopefully this time it'd be better. So this is actually really a survey talk. I mean, this topic is kind of, I think, way off to the side for most of you. So what I'm really going to do is basically give some sort of introduction to the subject. There are going to be a few new results. I mean, I guess the one new result that I'm going to talk about is joint work with these people, Jens Markloff, you know, and now Dave Witte and Dave Morris are actually the same person. When we started working, he was Dave Witte, and then he got married and changed his name to Dave Morris. So I'm sorry, but this is... So the problem is billiards in the polygon. This is supposedly one of the earliest dynamical systems ever studied, and somehow people thought it was going to be really easy, and they would solve this problem really quickly and move on to sort of more realistic, you know, problems. And one of the first things you want to study is like the number of periodic trajectories of a period at most t. I'm using Euclidean length for the period. And so you presumably want some upper bounds and lower bounds. And so now it's about 100 years later. The best known lower bound for the number of periodic trajectories is zero. So it's not known if any triangle has a periodic trajectory. Any acute triangle does, because you just look at the sort of shortest trajectory which touches all three sides. That's a better trajectory. But for a obtuse triangle, this doesn't work, and it's still very much an open problem. Various people have recently tried all kinds of computer-assisted approaches to this problem, and so far nothing has been very conclusive. I don't even know what the answer is. Now, the upper bound for the number of things, well, the best-known upper bound in this generality is that the number grows sub-exponentially in t. So there is clearly a bit of a gap in our understanding. And I mean, actually, as a matter of fact, I mean, this is a problem which is sort of, first, why would you study this kind of system? Well, that's not personally why I would study this system. Actually, I study for a completely different reason. But you could think this is sort of not very chaotic, but not integrable either. I mean, this has zero entropy. It has all kinds of strange features. So definitely not hyperbolic. A lot of the methods that people have developed over, you know, ergodics here, dynamical system, really don't work. So this is sort of your expectations if you want to do some sort of statistics of eigenvalues, which people, I think, presumably are interested in here, then it's kind of, you would not expect anything universal, but it's still sort of an interesting kind of intermediate system to study. Now, on the other hand, this problem of billiards and polygons...
You say that many people here don't really care about universal features, they just like to solve individual problems.
Okay, right, so... Okay.
Not a negative thing.
Okay, so... Okay, thanks for the positive comment. So this is, on the other hand, this is a particularly nasty individual problem. I mean, this thing is actually very few, there are no sort of general methods for this. There is no technology which anyone has ever developed which really work for this. And it's somehow, it's off on its own. It's a separate difficult problem, which is sort of doesn't have very much to do with the rest of mathematics as far as people know right now. On the other hand, if there is an assumption you can make, which is that you assume that the polygon is rational. So this is... So the polygon is rational if all the angles are multiples of pi. And so actually, you can see the whole slide, so there are all kinds of results about this, but somehow what happens is that once you assume that the polygon is rational, it is suddenly becoming very much connected to the modern mathematics. And I'll try to explain why, but right now it's actually a very active field, and the people that do this have all kinds of varied backgrounds, you know, from dynamical systems to algebraic geometry to all kinds of others, maybe some number theory. So there's some... it's quite a rich field, and I'll try to see why. Yeah, sorry. So anyway, so here is one reason why this thing is an advantage is that, well, you have the theorem by Howard Mazur. I think still it's actually for the number of periodic trajectories still the best theorem. And that is that if the polygon is rational, then the number of periodic trajectories grows quadratically. Well, actually, I have to be a little bit careful about what I mean by periodic trajectories. I said cylinders. It's actually, I'll get back to that point later. There are actually infinitely many if you don't count correctly, because every trajectory can be somehow translated parallel to itself. But it will be easier to explain when I get back to this later. And yeah, the question is, actually one of my motivations for this was the question of whether this can be converted to an asymptotic formula of, you know, how many of those are as the number goes to infinity. And so we always assume that the polygon is rational. I mean, I will have really nothing to say about irrational ones. So there are several advantages to dealing with rational polygons. Actually, once I assume rational triangle, whether it's triangle or not, doesn't really matter. It's somehow not all that essential. So there is this construction which you can make, which somehow converts the idea that if you start with a polygon, you can convert it to a surface. And this is sort of the obvious idea that if you, instead of reflecting the trajectory, you reflect the polygon. And so, like, for example, let me first do it in a very trivial example. I don't want to give a precise definition of what this is. Let's look at a rectangle, which is a little bit too trivial because it tiles the plane. But so you build this in a rectangle. Well, you know, if you want to count the number of periodic trajectories, you basically convert the problem how to count lattice points in the plane. And here we only care about the main term. The error term is sort of way beyond our reach. I guess, so if you start going like this, and instead of reflecting trajectory, just reflect the rectangle itself. And what I want to do is I want to do something short of tiling the plane by polygons, by rectangles. What I want to do is I want to make four copies. So you reflect like this, and when you get to this point, you reflect again. So I want to make only four copies and glue opposite sides. A trajectory like this is represented by a straight line path on this torus. So somehow the idea is that the billiard paths in the polygon are in one-to-one correspondent to straight lines on the surface which you make out of the polygon. Maybe it will be clear what happens if I do a less trivial example. So the less trivial example, if I start with this triangle, which has, it's like one of my favorite triangles, it has isosceles triangle with two angles of 2 pi over 5, then you do this reflection procedure. You basically keep on deflecting, but then when you have a chance to glue opposite sides, which are parallel, glue parallel sides, you do it. And so you get this regular tangon, and then you can glue opposite sides in the regular tangon. And that's sort of the surface you get. Now, if you believe in Gauss-Bonnet, this is a genus 2 surface. And it's interesting to figure out what happens to these points which correspond to the vertices. Well, the middle point is actually, doesn't matter, but like at this point, when you glue, all the green points are identified because you glued this to this, so you identify the green point, and so on. And then if you can figure out what the total angle at this point is, the total angle is the total angle is 4 pi. And also at this point, the total angle is also 4 pi. So you have sort of a conical singularity at each of those points. So these surfaces are sort of, they have a flat metric and they have conical singularities, which is sort of, you know, usually on a Riemann surface you put a hyperbolic metric, which on constant curvature minus 1, and here you put a Euclidean metric. Of course you can't because of Gauss-Bonnet. But you can concentrate the negative curvature at the singularities. So this is what the kind of metric appears here. It's actually, there is something extra here, which is there is a sort of a parallel line field on this surface, which I'll talk about later. But somehow the idea is that when you have the surface, then instead of looking at a billiard trajectory in the polygon, I can just go like this. And then when I get to a side, I just go to its opposite and I continue in the same direction. So somehow the trajectory, the billiard trajectories here kind of change directions, and on here they always go in the same direction. So this is one advantage of doing this. But so let me try to maybe a slightly more formal definition. That's still not going to be exactly a formal definition of what it is that you get. So the object actually does not have a well-recognized name. Various people use different names for this object. So I'm going to call it the translation surface. So the definition that sort of suggested by what I have over there, it's a union of polygons, which each one of them is sitting as a subset of R2. And so it already has an orientation. And so they're glued along parallel sides. And each side has to glue to exactly one other side, and the total angle at each vertex has to be 2 pi times an integer. So that's sort of the kind of definition that you have over there. It's, by the way, in this definition, I'm not requiring that all the polygons are congruent of the same polygon. You're just allowed to have different. And the second definition is slightly more scientific. It's a pair, a Riemann surface, and a holomorphic one form on the surface. So, so there is sort of a translation between how do you go from a surface to this kind of, how does this structure, what does this structure have to do with that? Well, actually also, I mean, I guess there is one more thing in the dictionary. The holomorphic one forms have zeros, and a zeroth order k corresponds to the conical singularity of angle 2 pi times k plus 1. And so what is the translation? Well, basically the idea is the following. So what does definition 1 tell you? Definition 1 tells you that it's really, one should think of it as a whole bunch of charts. So that somehow I'm thinking of the union of polygons. I'm just kind of dividing it up into charts. And the idea is that the transition functions.
We have a light on the blackboard.
Sorry. Sorry. Is it possible to see or not yet?
No.
Very difficult.
Okay.
Right on that blackboard there.
Okay, that's easier?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the transition functions, so basically are translations. So V going to V plus a constant. So you really have charts and you have maps from the charts to R2. And then on the overlap you have transition functions, and they're just translations. That's really what the first definition basically says. I'm ignoring the conical singularities right now. So you can identify R2 with C, and then you can think of this as Z going to Z plus C. So this is a holomorphic function. This means that you actually have a complex structure on the surface, which is given as above. And as a matter of fact, you not only do you have a holomorphic structure, you also have a one form, which is dz, which is invariant. So somehow when you have a union of polygons like this, you automatically have a structure of this type. And then how do you go backwards? Well, there is if you have this your surface, and then you look at some sort of a point where the form is not zero. So let's say omega of p is not equal to zero. If you look at the chart near here, then omega is equal to, let's say some sort of f of zeta d zeta. It has to look something like that in local coordinates. So there is this little lemma. There exists a local coordinate z such that omega is equal to dz. There is a change of variable. Actually, z is really the integral of this. Z is really the integral from some base point. But it doesn't really matter. And so this the important thing is that this Z is unique up to translation. So this automatically gives you. So if you try to use this coordinate everywhere in every chart, then the transition functions automatically have to be translations, and so you get structure of this type.
Good for something?
Is this description? Yes. I mean, somehow, there are a number of things it's good for. Some of them are easier than others, but at some point this is really beginning to come in. Probably not in most of what I want to talk about. Okay, so there's some notation. I have to fix the singularity types. So the alpha is just encode the total angles of the singularities. This is notation for this kind of the set of translation services. So with these singularity types, it's called a stratum. And it's sort of like a moduli space of something. Now, so you would think that, you know, so before I talked about how do you define this, this advantage of this construction, the advantage of rationality is you can make the surface, right, and somehow I said that, well, it's easier to think of things on the surface because on the surface you don't have to turn anywhere in terms of the build trajectory, just go straight. That's really not the reason that rational polygons are easier. The real reason is something which is coming up right now, and that is that there is an SL to R action on this space. And somehow this allows you to consider the SL to somehow trade your original dynamical system, which is extremely unfriendly, namely builders in the polygon. This is flying away. For a new dynamical system, which is really the action of the group SL to R on the moduli space of translation surfaces. And that new dynamical system has perhaps nicer properties. And so here is what the SL to R action is. It's actually very easy to explain. So if you start with there's a surface as a union of polygons, then, well, each polygon is sitting inside R2. And so SL to R acts on R2 by the linear action, not the fractional linear, just the linear action. And so it acts on each polygon. And this action, I mean, the polygons were glued together, so I have to be able to glue the polygons after I act, but that's okay because sides which are parallel before remain parallel after, so I can glue them. And so this is just a new surface, it's just apply the action to each polygon. So it's really somehow generalizes. So if you start with a surface which is made out of triangles like this, and then let's apply maybe an element like this from SL to R, then what you're going to do is you're going to kind of skew each triangle. Yeah, I don't know, I'm going to try to draw it very well. It's hard to draw, but it's just that's all it does. It's really generalizing the action on the torus. And so somehow, essentially, all the progress in the last 15 years on this problem has had to do with this action. Now, you can define the Veitch group of a surface. I guess maybe I should here is a jump ahead to the following slide. You can actually, I think this is, I'm going to mention this because I'll probably come back to this later. So you can actually count using the SL to R action. And so the idea is the following, is that you can just sort of, if you want to count periodic trajectories, there is sort of a formula which expresses a number in terms of a certain integral over the SL to R orbit of your surface. And somehow the ergodic properties of this orbit have to do with having the correct somehow, you know, so this is an example of, this is a number of periodic trajectories on the surface. Actually, I can, instead of on the polygon, I should really count periodic trajectories on the surface. So the periodic trajectories correspond to sort of straight lines. So I'm looking at straight line trajectories of a certain length which don't pass through singularities. And then this counts the number of such trajectories in an annulus. And the right-hand side is a certain integral, which I'll come back to later, which has to do with the sort of, these are certain, AT and R theta, certain matrices in SL2, and F hat is a certain function, which is sort of explicitly defined. And
true for any S or any of each?
This is true for any S. This is a formula. Essentially, what this formula is corresponds to the following. It's instead of, yeah, here is, this is the idea. The idea is the following, that if you, so, whenever you have a periodic trajectory on the surface, so the periodic trajectory corresponds to a vector. Namely, because, see, each periodic trajectory corresponds to a straight line, right, which has a certain length in a certain direction, right? So there is a vector associated to it, right? So there is just, so, and now, each vector, so somehow the idea is that you have your original surface and there are somehow, there, some of those vectors are very, very long, right? So it can be long, long periodic trajectories. And so, so I have some sort of long vector in R2. I can apply an element of SL2. So I have, I then have this sort of, what I'm doing is I have a standard window, which is actually, it happens to be a trapezoid, for technical reasons, which is of this size. And then you can apply an element of SL2 to take this vector and move it, so this vector could be some very long, move it into this trapezoid. And then F hat actually is a function which counts a number, or F hat of a surface is a number of periodic trajectories which land in trapezoid. I mean, whose vectors actually are in the trapezoid. So it's, so what is happening here is that, so you can apply, so you can actually, instead of taking a fixed surface and counting long trajectories, you can apply an element of SL2 and count only trajectories in this trapezoid, but then then you're no longer counting on the same surface. And so this way, by just bringing various kind of blocks of R2 into this trapezoid, you end up with an integral over the SL2R orbit. And that sort of explains why you have this formula. It's actually I think the formal proof is shorter than the heuristic explanation I gave, but I think this is easier to understand what's going on. And so that is actually one reason why the how the SL2 is used.
This SL2 is a theta integral and a diagonal.
Yeah, it's like a circle inside SL2. It's large circles.
It isn't over the diagonal. It's just over the theta.
Right, exactly. Integrals over the theta.
Like a Horow cycle, which is experimental.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's very close to a Horow cycle, so it's really.
But how's the little t related to capital T?
It's not.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. It says that.
Okay.
So it's just. So it's actually important to understand the SL2R orbits of things. Now, presumably, by ergodic theory, most orbits are dense. But it's not all, and an extreme example of something which is not dense is something which is closed. And here is a definition of this is. You can talk about. If you look at the action of SL2 on the surface, you can define the stabilizer. The stabilizer is called the Veitch group. And the surface is called a Veitch surface if the stabilizer is a lattice inside SL2. And this is equivalent to having the orbit being closed. So inside, so this is a...
Orbit meaning?
The SL2 R orbit being closed, on the moduli space being closed. And so these are actually quite remarkable objects. There are actually two different kinds. There is arithmetic and non-arithmetic. Yeah, by the way, one thing which is true is that for a Veitch surface, before I get to arithmetic, there is an asymptotic formula of this kind, and it's actually not, it's not originally derived this way, but from this formula up there, it's very easy to derive this, because what this is really saying is that this is because of the fact that if S is Veitch and the orbit is closed, so this integral up there, which really originally takes place in this huge moduli space, is now really taking place in the closed orbit, which is really just SL2R mod gamma. So here you are just doing some ergodic theory in SL2R mod gamma, which is fairly well understood. You're really just equidistribution of large circles, which is standard fact, and you get this quadratic formula.
The orbit is not closed. You don't know that the trajectory is ergodic on this moduli space.
Right.
So you don't know how to compute the phase-space average.
Okay, these are actually two issues. I'm actually going to talk about both of them. One is you don't know whether the trajectory is uniformly distributed. You know that almost all trajectories are uniformly distributed. But if somebody gives you a polygon, then you make a surface out of it, they're asking questions about that particular surface. And so that's just appealing to the ergodic theorem is not very satisfying. So you will never answer your question. Yeah. There is also another issue which makes this problem more acute, is that not all surfaces come from polygons. The set of surfaces which come from polygons actually has measure zero. you will not make a sensible statement about polygons by considering almost all surfaces. On the other hand, I will talk about almost all surfaces anyway, because we can.
But perhaps you might tell us.
Yeah.
SL2 is now acting on the space. There's an invariant measure. How's it related to Teichmuller distance or metric?
Okay, yes. I was actually going to suppress this, but the action of the diagonal...
There is an invariant measure.
Yes, there is an invariant measure. The invariant measure actually I'm going to describe. It's very easy to describe. It's just like hard measure for SL2. For SLM. So I'll describe the invariant measure. The action of the diagonal has to do with the Teichmuller map. So these orbits are isometrically embedded in the Teichmuller metric. And that's sometimes called Teichmuller disks.
I mean, this kind of ergodic theory was discovered first by Veitch and Thurston, or by Teichmuller people?
Mazur and Veitch looked at the dynamics of this as a dynamical system. I mean, certainly Teichmuller knew about the distance and about... I think everybody sort of knew about SL2, they're complex geodesics or something, but nobody thought of it as a dynamical system in terms of ergodic theory or something. Yeah, so this actually, a lot of the subjects is very old and some of it is just there. So anyway, let me just come back to Veitch surface for a moment. So there are really two different types of Veitch surfaces. There are arithmetic and non-arithmetic. The arithmetic ones are really branch covers of a torus. And they are quite easy to understand in many ways. And there are sort of different ways of understanding them. One of them, I didn't say what V of S is, but gamma of S is just the Veitch group. And if the Veitch group is commensurable to SL2Z, then it's equivalent to saying that your branch cover of a torus. And by the way, branch cover of a torus just means that the surface is really tiled by squares. So an example would be, and they all kind of look like this, if you take three squares and then you glue things, like for example, glue this to this, glue this to that, glue this to that, and then glue this to that. That's one of those. And so you can imagine that the which this has a affine automorphism group, which is a switch group, and it's going to be commensurable to SL2Z.
Some fine. L-shaped integers is
anything tiled by squares. Anything tiled by squares. So there is this coordinate system, which I'll describe in a moment, and if the coordinates are rational, then you're this. Now, there are some non-arithmetic surfaces. These are actually extremely difficult to understand. They're actually not, for a while it wasn't clear if there are any non-arithmetic ones. Veach had the first examples. He basically looked at the regular hang-ons. And they work. And somehow, until very, very recently, all the examples were basically related to regular hang-ons. They are somehow... even the fact that regular hang-on is Veach is a fairly long computation. It's somehow you have to exhibit the Veach group and show it's a lattice. There are only a few more examples done, and actually very recently there is actually somehow a big revolution in the subject, but only in one case. So in the stratum H2, which is the smallest non-trivial stratum, we now understand this problem completely. And there is a three-integer parameter family. There are various ways to describe it. And Kai Kalta is my student, and Kurt McMullen also did roughly at the same time. And this family is actually all the Veach surfaces in H2. So somehow there is this amazing dichotomy. In this particular stratum, there is an infinite family, and we understand all of them. And in every other stratum, we only know a finite collection of examples, which are basically the regular hang-ons.
I know in the Veach, say, with a pentagon, this turned out to be a triangle group at angle pi over 5.
Yeah. Nobody knows what the group is. Somehow the proof works in the following way. You, by some very, very indirect argument, you show that the SL2R orbit is closed. And therefore, there must be a stabilizer. And that's it. Even in a specific example. Actually, McMullen has tried.
I know it's non-arithmetic is because you a priori know there are only finitely many arithmetic.
No, the reason you know it's non-arithmetic because it has to be non-uniform. And therefore, and if it's arithmetic, it has to be commensurable to SL2Z. But if it's commensurable to SL2Z, it has to be a branch cover of a torus, which means it's tiled by squares, and you can tell it's not tiled by squares. So that's sort of not an issue, but figuring out what the actual group itself is an issue. I mean, what is easy to compute by hand is the subgroup generated by the unipotent elements. Unfortunately, if the quotient has genus higher than 1, it has infinite index. And so you don't really know how to make sort of hyperbolic elements of this group.
What's the technique to show something opposed orbit with
that? I'll show you. There is a very long story. It's not there is some invariance involved, and there is some very, very long computation. McMullen does this using complex real multiplication Jacobian variety, and Kalta does it in a different way. But it's a very long story, and there is actually an amazing... we are very far from understanding this in any other situation. Somehow, the major problem is to try to understand...
These are non-arithmetic groups, but no doubt they conjugate to things with algebraic...
The groups have algebraic integers. The entries all have algebraic integers. Everything here lives in a number field. Now, let me maybe just try to quickly get to maybe point to some new results. So you can ask which triangles are which. This is something which has been done by Kenyon and Smiley, and there are actually very few Veach triangles also that is completely classified. Veach triangles means which surfaces which make other triangles are Veach surfaces. And then you get some sort of a few families and a few exceptions. Basically, the isosceles ones are the biggest family is this one. You take a regular triangle with vertices pi over n, like this. This is a Veach triangle. So here is what... here is a construction we are going to do. If you look at, imagine taking the right triangle is also a Veach triangle. But if you take this and put it over here, look at this triangle is not Veach. it turns out. But on the other hand, we actually still have an asymptotic formula for the number of periodic trajectories in here. This is a new result, which I might want to talk about later. I want to put this in context later. So this actually turns out that the surface you make out of this is a branch cover of a beach surface. So it's not beach itself, but it retains some of the features. It doesn't have all the features of a beach. There is no group, but it still has a lot of the geometry.
What's CN?
It's possible to compute CN.
I think I always ask, it's not some, in these examples, not a natural invariant feature.
No, it's not unreasonable to. I mean, I think it's actually not that bad for this. It's a rational number, I think. But I have to compute again what CN is. But in the final version, I think we are going to say it's possible to say that CN is this. The actual computation is long. Here is another example where you can actually compute the asymptotic or periodic trajectories, and this is an example where you start with a builder in a rectangle like this. And I'm sorry you didn't ask a question about what is the constant for this one, because for this one I happen to know, and I've computed this in great detail for some reasons. So the constant here is something like, is that?
Yeah.
And it's independent of, alpha is not rational.
Yeah, P, one of those.
No, nothing is a P.
It doesn't depend on P.
Which actually sort of makes sense, because we know that... the surface, if you make it a surface, this happens to lie in the stratum H11. But I'm saying this is two singular points in genus 2. And then the theorem that I have, which I'm going to... Almost every S in H11, N of ST is asymptotic to 5 T squared. So the idea is that as Q goes to infinity, which means imagine you take some sort of irrational beta and you approximate it by fractions like this, then you would think that the alpha, this thing with alpha and beta is actually generic in the stratum, so its constant should be 5, and the constants of these should converge to that constant. So this is really does work out in this case, and the general conjecture should suggest that this should work out in every case, and we have no idea if that's true or not. But, I mean, that's somehow the optimal situation. You should have this kind of constant should have some sort of a continuity property like this.
The general conjecture would be that every triangle has such E squared with a constant, and that constant has this ruler function.
Yes, exactly. This conjecture is that somehow you are not allowed to approximate rationals by irrationals, but you are allowed to do the opposite. And so this by analogy with homogeneous spaces, this would be the case, the conjectures. So now right now we can only do this for very, very special families. And so the general case is far from solved. But let me actually talk about... Right now, let me get away from what we can't do. Let me talk about what we can do. And so this is a theorem. Is it possible to see this blackboard right now? Barely? Maybe if I write it on... Should I write it on this? Let me write it. Maybe it's here as possible. So this is due to Howard Mazur and myself. For almost every there exists a constant. So there is this constant depending only on the stratum, such as for almost all surfaces you have this asymptotic formula. And this is kind of natural from this picture. It just says that almost all orbits are uniformly distributed. The issue is, how do you compute this C of beta? And there is actually a sort of interesting phenomenon which occurs, which I wanted to sort of talk about, because it's, you know, it's not on the slides, because it actually relates to the talk we heard yesterday about families of periodic trajectories. So here is one feature of these surfaces. Whenever you have a periodic trajectory, so suppose this point is really the same as this point. So imagine if you have this thing is glued to that. Then this trajectory is also going to be periodic, because you can just slide the trajectory parallel to itself and get another periodic trajectory, somehow property of zero curvature. And you can do that until you hit a singular point somewhere, maybe somewhere out here. So then what you end up is, maybe the same thing will happen on the other side. So you end up with a cylinder of periodic trajectories. And what I'm really counting is not number of periodic trajectories, because it's infinite, but the number of cylinders. Now, it is possible that you... So to each cylinder is associated a vector, which is this vector. This is unique. It's possible to have two cylinders with the same vector, right? With the same... By this, I mean two... Another same length and same direction. Somewhere else on the surface, you also have a cylinder which is doing this. Now, the question is, how likely is this? So imagine that I have, take the more generic surface S, and let's say in... And let's look at the most generic stratum. So it's like there, you only talk about simple zeros. So this is the most non
least curvature.
Least special somehow thing, the biggest stratum. And the question is, suppose I pick an arbitrary surface in here, and then suppose I find a periodic, you know, there are quadratically many of these directions. Suppose I find some direction in which there is a periodic trajectory, and therefore there is a cylinder. And then the question is, what is the probability that somewhere else on the same surface, I'll find a cylinder in the same direction, sort of like this? Now, I was absolutely sure this was zero. Then you can also ask, what is the probability you'll find another cylinder of the same direction and the same length? And this looks completely ridiculous. But it turns out that you can... So one way to measure this is you can count the number of... Let me call this quantity N2. This is a number... N2. This is a number of directions in which there are two cylinders of the same length in the same direction. So this is like multiplicity 2 vectors. And so it turns out that N2 is actually, if genus is at least bigger than or equal to 3, is asymptotic to something, some other constant. Also grows quadratically for almost every surface. So it means that you actually have a positive probability of, if you find one, there is a positive probability you'll find another one.
These are orbits with the
same direction, same length, which are completely disjoint from each other. You cannot deform one to the other.
They're really distinct orbits.
They're really distinct orbits. And it turns out that it actually happens to... It turns out that even Ng minus 1 of ST is asymptotic to some constant. But anything beyond that, Ng... It does not grow quadratically. So the last one is g minus 1.
Is that true in your sort of special one parameter family as well?
In this one parameter family, it's not true. This is true generically.
Right.
In this particular family, what you have is in this actually happens in every everything which is either Veitch or cover of Veitch, and also in some other mysterious situations. This is something which is called complete periodicity, which is the following bizarre property that whenever you have a finite direction which there is a periodic trajectory, the entire surface decomposes into cylinders in that direction. So there is this complete, the whole surface, the flow in that direction is completely periodic. And so, so these are special, but you somehow think that you could generically should kill this, but you can't. And so now there is a, you can actually also ask what are all these constants. And it turns out that there is a way to compute them. And somehow the answers, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, so the answer, so I have like 5 minutes left, right?
Well,
10 minutes. Yeah, so the answers are somehow, I don't have the slide with the actual thing. I was looking for it earlier. I somehow lost it. But in genus 2, somehow the answer is like, seems like 5. I'm actually going to tell you roughly what the situation is. And in genus equal to 3, then there are really two numbers. There are actually something like 3. So right now, I only remember the denominators. There is, so this is actually, yeah.
Could you try sliding down one of these blackboards and using it?
Okay, so let me just make, should I get rid of, sorry, how do I turn this off? Doesn't seem. All right, I'll just leave it. Anybody knows how to raise it up?
God's sake, all this high-tech stuff.
Just press all buttons and see what happens.
Nice. For God's sake,
read the manual.
Okay, we needed a pencil.
I like that. It's just maybe you can call it back. Switch all that.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm sorry about the, I actually took the time while we so this is something like so, and so these are all zeros here, so somehow what happens is that denominators,
what is this table of?
Okay, so this is a table of the following. This is a tuple of this constant in the quadratic asymptotic formula, and here I've actually this is all
for the repetition
for the principles. This is all for the principal stratum in genus G. So they're all
G equals 2 means you have two distinct periodic orbits.
No. G equals 2 means you have surface of genus 2. M is what you said. M is
the
multiplicity.
Of orbits,
it's periodic orbits, right? Same direction. So M is actually always at most G minus 1. You get to get non-zero answer. So these are all zeros. And now the denominators actually are possible to compute. So this is some dumb number, which I don't remember the numerator, but I remember the denominator here is like 23357, which is, I think, a prime. So so it's actually not likely this has a simple answer. So the... But I forgot exactly what the numerals are. But it's something, so there is no point in writing them down. But there are somehow some sort of complicated constants like this. It's possible to figure them out. And maybe I'll spend the last few minutes trying to tell you how to figure them out. And and this is sort of kind of what we understand about the generic surface. So it's actually we have a fairly complete understanding. We know exactly what can happen generically and what doesn't. And also, what are the quadratic gross constants? What we cannot tell is whether any given surface is generic. That requires sort of classifying all the non-generic ones and then and doing, kind of going on from there. So let me now tell you a little bit more about where these constants come from. So first I have to tell you what is this function f hat over here. F hat of S is a surface, let me just define V of S. This is a set of vectors corresponding to periodic trajectories, to cylinders of periodic trajectories on S. So this is a subset of R2. It's not a group, but it's somehow you can think of it somewhat like Z2. It's discrete, not uniformly discrete. And you can define the following. F hat of S is a sum over... So if F is really a function here from R2 to R, it's really in the formula up there, F is a characteristic function of this trapezoid. So this F hat just counts the number of things in this trapezoid. So there is this, turns out that you can actually integrate, there is this formula which is analogous, all of this is actually really an analogy of this Ziegel's work on lattices. If you look at, I'll define the measure if I have time in a minute. So I'm taking this thing and I'm averaging it with respect to the moduli space. I'm here divided by, make sure I average respect probability measure. It turns out that this is equal to the integral of R2 of F. So if those people... Yes, sorry. So it turns out that actually if this was in the space of lattices, you would take this function and then average over space of lattices, you get this. Turns out this formula is not true here. There is a corrective constant, which is what I call C of beta. This C of beta is actually also basically the answer up there. These are the so this is these are really the numbers you want to compute. Now the one yeah.
Related to some volumes of pi equivalence.
Yeah. So let me just say it really quickly what I want to say. So first, where does this formula come from? Well, this formula comes from it's actually very easy. You just think of this, the right-hand side, as a linear functional on F. So think of how it depends on F. It's some linear map from functions to numbers, right? So it's really kind of like integral of f with respect to some measure on R2. But then this is SL2R invariant. Therefore, this measure is SL2R invariant. So what are the SL2R invariant measures? Well, there is Lebesgue measure plus delta function at a point, and then you just show that delta function at a point doesn't arise. So this formula is sort of fairly soft.
You need to be able to compute one integral.
That's a problem.
Sure. So this is true for every f. This is called the Siegel-Beach formula. So to compute C, you let f be the characteristic function of the epsilon ball, and then let epsilon go to zero. So if you do that, then what happens is that what is this side? When is it non-zero? So f hat. So if f is the characteristic function of the epsilon ball, f hat of s is not equal to zero when s has a closed geodesic of length at most epsilon, by definition. So you're kind of tending to the boundary of the moduli space here. Now, what happens on the boundary of moduli space? Well, you find that there are moduli spaces of lower dimension. So if you actually do this very carefully, it actually takes several hundred pages to do this very carefully, but if you do it, you get the following formula that C of beta, I'm going to write it there are some sort of combinatorial coefficients which are easy, but then you end up with ratios of the volumes, as Peter has said. So you end up with some sort of constant like the formula like this. So all of this is sort of not all that useful unless you can actually compute the volumes. And there is also a way to do that.
Yes, P is explicit.
P is explicit. P is some sort of factorials, which is not which is fairly easy to it's
way,
easy to write it up to a factor of 2. It's hard to get to
factor. Ziegler used this formula to compute the volume
exactly
this way.
No, exactly. So this is actually very natural. The only problem is that, I mean, this is actually also the way I was actually thinking of trying to do this first. I mean, you sort of, it's some sort of, here it's a little bit circular because you don't know what the C is. And so you cannot, I mean, for Siegel, the C was 1. So you get the recursive formula for the volumes. And so here we are somewhat stuck. You need to have another ingredient. Well, there is another way to compute the volumes, which is not due to Siegel, but it's actually the following.
This is not the volume in the Wey Peterson. That's I think a given. It's the volume or none. It's the volume in this. That's
well,
what I keep on asking.
Yeah, okay, so here let me tell you what the measure is. Okay,
good.
So the measure is the following. This is actually has to do with the Teichmuller.
Yeah.
So the measure is, and here I'll talk about the. Sorry, is it a
narration? Describe the top like bullets down.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so here's the idea. So you have S is really, you have the surface and a holomorphic one form. So on the surface, so there are actually some singular points, but let me, you can actually pick a basis for the homology. Let's say integer coefficients. Actually, to be precise, I have to do relative homology to the singular points. But so relative homology to the singular points, it means that these are singular points. I also consider this as a cycle and add it to my basis. So let's call this basis gamma 1 up to gamma n. And then you define the following map. Going to be an n-tuple. So this is an element of Cn. And the point is that this is a local coordinate system. So this is exactly analogous to picking a base. If you pick a basis for the lattice, then in terms of those bases, the space of lattices becomes n by n matrices. So here, instead of n by n matrices, you really have Cn, which is R2 to the n. So now that is you can say, what is the measure that you use? Well, you use Lebesgue measure here. And this Lebesgue measure it's invariant under the, I mean, if you choose different bases, you're going to be off by some sort of symplectic matrix, which is not going to change the notion of measure.
I think this is sometimes called the Arkellov method. It's from a flat metric on the...
Yeah, there is a scientific name for this.
That's in a Mod ordinary.
So here it's actually not only do you get a measure, you get a measure with normalization because you can look at the Z. Lebesgue measure is normalized, so you can actually ask what the volume is. And here is how you compute what the volume is. So I'm just running out of blackboard space. There is no eraser, so. Anybody has an eraser? Yeah, okay, let me try to fit it in here. So actually, this is not quite what the measure is. The problem. So the measure is, the problem is it is the following. It's somehow, if you rescale the surface by a factor, then, I mean then all the coordinates change, and somehow this is like a cone. So what we really have to do is, in order to get something of finite measure, you want to restrict the surface of having total area 1. And what this really is somehow, here is the picture, so you have this R2 to the n. And then inside this, you have the Lebesgue measure on this space. Here you have the surfaces of area equal to 1. And these are the, So we really want to take this measure from this space and restrict this of hyperboloid of area equal to 1. Actually, this area is actually turns out to be quadratic form in these coordinates, so it's really is a hyperboloid. These are really the Riemann-Horowitz relations. And so now the way you do it is if you want to define a measure of a set here, then the easiest way to do it is just to define it to be the measure of the cone, which is passing through the set. This is roughly how SQL does it. So that defines a measure here. So now what do we really want? We have a measure of a fundamental domain. So here, imagine you have a fundamental domain for this thing, and you want the measure of the fundamental domain. So it's really the measure of the cone based on the fundamental domain. So there is a trick, and this trick also applies. I haven't actually read it directly in the for homogeneous spaces, but I'm sure it's implicit. It's in Z. Okay, it isn't. Okay, thanks. So the trick is the following. Let's first do a cosmetic step. Let's rescale the area to be R, and let's think of R equal to being large. So the volume of the fundamental domain, which is really the measure of C1 of F, is really the same thing as the measure of CR of F. Well, it's Lebesgue measure of C1 of F. It's Lebesgue measure of CR of F. And then you divide it by R to the N, I think is the correct normalization. So this is a trivial identity. So I want to compute the measure of this big cone. This is just Euclidean, the Lebesgue measure. So here is something which you use in reverse. This is asymptotic to the number of integer points. So usually the number of integer points is asymptotic to the volume, and here you do the opposite. The volume is asymptotic to the number of integer points. So now, what are the integer points? Well, it turns out that this is the integer points, and I don't have time to say why, but it's actually, I think you can probably figure it out for yourself. It's very, very easy. This is the number of branch covers. Each such integer point corresponds to these arithmetic leaf surfaces I mentioned before. These are branch covers of tori. This is the number of branch covers of tori. I guess, well, they have to be in the stratum, so they have to have certain singularity types. And then this is again divided by R to the N. So this means that you can really compute the volume by just counting these branch covers. And this is a purely combinatorial problem. It's fairly nasty, but it's doable by people like Andrea Kunkov. And so you actually have to take the limit as the area goes to infinity. So this is actually the number of branch covers of degree at most R, because the base torus of this is number of branch covers of a standard torus, really. You just basically figure out how many ways there are to make a surface out of squares like this, and then that gives you the asymptotics. And so this is where those strange numbers come from, is by just analyzing this. Anyway,
okay,
thanks.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Yeah.
So this explanation says that all your constants should be rational.
Yeah, this is actually, yeah. The actual volume, this is actually conjectured by Koncevich, and it's true that the volume is always pi to the, is always a rational number times pi to the 2g. And there is actually some extra issues here, because it turns out that the modular space is not always connected, and so you want every connected component, and that also can be done, but it's much more.
Peterson, it's also it's a similar theorem, there's no relation between.
I think there is no relation. I mean, I think they seem to be very different. I mean, also what happens is that these things are somehow, if you require a zero very large degree,
right,
then not every Riemann surface has got one. So it's really a volume of something smaller.
Yeah,
well, I think as I since we are quite late, I think Or is there an urgent question still? I think we thank the speaker again and we come back to the next.